Welcome to Joy Connection, your journey to well-balanced living podcast series. Please welcome your host, Ralph Weaver.
Hi, I'm Ralph Weaver, and welcome to EWC Joy Connection, Journey to Well-Balanced Living. Thank you for being here, and we have an exciting episode today, one that will leave you hopefully feeling motivated and grateful. His story is one of encountering the unthinkable. Terry Tucker has reinvented himself over the years, beginning as a graduate from the Citadel and employed in the marketing department of Wendy's International in Dublin. From there, he worked in hospital administration and as a customer service manager, and eventually became a police officer with the Cincinnati Police Department. Terry became a SWAT hostage negotiator, but following a family relocation to Texas, he started a school security consulting business. While his professional background is extensive and impressive, his personal story of being diagnosed with a rare form of cancer called acral lentiginous melanoma in 2012. Terry's cancer presented at the bottom of the foot. It metastasized to a lymph node in his groin. Because his cancer is so rare, Terry was treated at the world-renowned MD Anderson Cancer Center and had not only two surgeries to remove the tumor, but was put on a weekly injection of a drug for 5 years that ultimately became so toxic for his body that he ended up in the ICU fighting for his life once again. Unfortunately, the cancer returned in 2017, which led to a foot amputation a year later. The cancer reemerged again in 2019, requiring multiple operations. In February of 2020, an undiagnosed tumor in Terry's ankle fractured his tibia. Terry's only remedy was the amputation of his left foot above the knee. He also had tumors in both of his lungs. Despite all of the pain and trauma, Terry found a way to make his pain a source of drive to fight. He became stronger and more resolute and eventually wrote a book called Sustainable Excellence: 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life to help people find and live their purpose. The book outlines certain principles to reinforce your attitude, no matter how much pain or obstacles needed to overcome, so you could live a life of significance and success. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Terry Tucker.
Great job.
Well, thank you, Ralph. I'm excited to talk with you today.
Well, it's having read your book, Terry, I'm just so excited about talking with you today, because when you think of one's purpose in life, it's something that I know, regardless of one's age, that we often grapple with. So let's start at the beginning. As I mentioned, you've professionally worn many hats and have experienced in many different parts of business. From your perspective, what was it like to transition to different fields?
I mean, there was always a big learning curve for me, and again, part of it, as you just mentioned, was finding that purpose, that passion, that why in my life. And, you know, if you sort of understand a little bit about the backstory, my passion had always been to go into law enforcement, but my paternal grandfather was a Chicago police officer from 1924 to 1954. So he was in Chicago during the height of Prohibition, when alcohol was outlawed in the United States, during the Great Depression, late 20s, early 1930s. And when the gangs, you know, Al Capone and those guys, were shooting up the town, and he was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. And my dad remembered the stories of that my grandmother told, my dad was an infant at the time, of the knock on the door of, "Mrs. Tucker, grab your son, come with us, your husband's been shot." And so when I expressed this interest in finding my passion, My dad was like, absolutely not. You're going to go to college. You're going to major in business. You're going to get out, get a great job, get married, have 2.4 kids, and live happily ever after. That's the life my father wanted me to live. That wasn't the passion that I felt I was supposed to live. And so when I graduated from college, I had a dilemma. My father was dying of cancer. I could either say, sorry, Dad, I'm going to go blaze my own trail, or out of love and respect for him, I could go into business. And that's what I did. I enjoyed business. It was something that I learned a lot with. I got some life experience, but it just wasn't in my heart. It wasn't something that I knew I was supposed to do with the rest of my life.
Well, was there a moment where you just said, or defining moment where you said, okay, I have to really follow my dreams or follow my passion? What was that period like until you became self-aware of what you wanted to do in terms of following your passion?
I always knew it was there. It was something that was in my heart. It was something that I believed I was supposed to do. But again, you know, I was sort of on the fence. And, you know, my parents were tremendous individuals. I have two brothers. We were all athletes. We, you know, my parents kind of did that divide and conquer parenting where, you know, Terry's got a game over here, Dad will go with that, and Larry's got a practice over here, and Mom will go to that. And so we were constantly running in a million different directions. But my parents showed me the value, or taught me the value of loving each other, of supporting each other, of caring for each other. So when my dad got sick, there was no doubt in my mind that I was going to put my passion, my dreams on hold and take care of him. And I sort of joke, it was, you know, I did what every good son did. I waited till my father passed away, and then I followed my passion. And literally, I was a 37-year-old rookie police officer, which by most accounts is pretty old to be getting into that line of work.
And did you know immediately once you became a police officer that you were following your passion? What did that feel like?
I did. It's a sort of an interesting story. My wife and I had been married. I at the time I was a hospital administrator in Columbus, Ohio, and my wife has always been the primary breadwinner, and we moved to Santa Barbara, California. And just by chance, one day a circular came in the mail from Santa Barbara City College, and there was a class that was offered that if you passed the class, you could apply to be a reserve police officer with any jurisdiction within the state of California. And so that night at dinner, you can imagine this conversation. It's like, hey, hon, I'd like to go through this class and then see where it takes me. And my wife was incredibly supportive. So I took the class. I got on as a reserve officer with the city of Santa Barbara. And what I would do is I would work all week at my normal job. You mentioned I was a customer service manager for an academic publishing company. And then I would come home Friday night, put on my police uniform, go to roll call, and work all night. And my wife used to say, you would come home exhausted, but with this incredible smile on your face. And she will tell you, I knew right then and there that that's what you were supposed to do.
And Terry, if you could speak a little bit about, say, decisions that you made and so many other people are reluctant to make because maybe money is the driving force, that they stay in a profession or a job that they just do not like, but because of, you know, the need financially to do something, they continue to follow that course.
And yeah, that's a really good point that you make, Ralph, because I think we all like to think that our passion or our purpose or our why in life is our job. And I mean, your job could be over here. It's the thing you do to pay the bills because, you know, you've got responsibilities, you've got a family, you've got kids and things like that. But your passion could be over here. Maybe that's writing or volunteering or podcasting or starting a philanthropic organization. Whatever it is that's in your heart, it doesn't necessarily have to be your job or your profession. So I guess that's a really good point you bring up, because I think a lot of times we think that our, you know, well, if I'm finding my purpose, that's got to be what I do for a living. It doesn't. They can be two different things. So I realize that people have responsibilities, and I certainly applaud them for you know, maintaining those responsibilities. But at the same time, I mean, I had responsibilities. I had bills to pay. But getting up and going to work every day was like, it was a drudgery. And yes, I learned things. Yes, I worked with great people, but it wasn't my passion. And I just felt in my heart that there was something else I was supposed to be doing. And I certainly took a pay cut when I went from the corporate sector to being a policeman full time. I was lucky that, like I said, my wife was the primary breadwinner, because I don't know if I would have been able to do that if I didn't have that safety net.
And then when you said at 37 years old, that's when you decided to, you know, pursue your passion. And I would imagine those, your wife and your loved ones probably saw a difference in Terry, in your attitude. Probably you were smiling more. Talk a little bit about that.
I felt fulfilled. I couldn't wait to get, you know, to get up in the morning, or actually I worked nights my entire police career, you know, so to get up at night and go to work, you know, because I wanted to make a difference. And I felt I was making a difference as a police officer. Not that I wasn't making a difference in the corporate side or when I was a hospital administrator, but this was just, I knew this was what I was supposed to do. So, you know, it didn't matter how tired I was. It didn't matter, you know, that I was in court till, you know, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I had to work at 11 o'clock that night and stuff like that. And the other thing I think that's important is you have to understand your priorities. And my priorities were always my family. My family came first. Being a police officer was my passion. I always felt that I could do other things if I needed to, but that was the passion for which I think God really called me to do.
And one of the things I was impressed by was the innovation that you brought to policing and what you did. And you were thinking outside of the box and in terms of, you know, your approach to working in the community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you initially you start out, every police officer starts out, you know, in uniform, in a marked car, running a beat, running a particular area, answering radio runs, doing self-initiated things like that. And we had, my partner and I were what was called a hot car. We were a two-man car, and we got all the gun runs, the shooting runs, the stabbings, and the dangerous stuff, because Cincinnati pretty much ran single-person cars. And so we had a lot of issues with drugs on our beat, and we were trying to figure out how to deal with that. And I think I tell this story in the book where the drug dealers had lookouts, and those lookouts were usually on foot. Well, the lookouts decided that they would use bicycles, and so they could have a farther reach. They could get out farther and let the dealer know when the police were in the area so he could stop selling. And so we knew this. We knew what was going on, but it was, how do you use the law? How do you stay within the law to stop that? And so, you know, we looked up vehicle codes for the state and for the city, and we found one that was basically, you can't ride a bicycle on the sidewalk if you're over 18. You have to have a light on it. Yeah, all these different things that were required. And so we just started using the vehicle code to stop people that were on bicycles that were riding on the sidewalk. And then we'd give them a ticket because they were the spotters for the drug dealers. And then over time, those people didn't have the money to pay the tickets. So we'd wait a while, you know, keep their name and date of birth, run them in our in-car computer. Oh, that guy's got a warrant. We'd stop him, confiscate his bike, take him to jail. He had to spend time in jail. And eventually the drug dealers stopped doing that because they had two choices. Well, I don't have spotters now because they're all in jail, or I'm going to have to pay the tickets. And it was a $125 ticket at the time to go ahead and make sure that, you know, these guys can continue to ride bikes and warn me. So it was kind of a cat and mouse game, but it was using the law as a way to try to stop the drug dealers from expanding their business.
Now, how did you make the transition from police officer to then hostage negotiator? And because I know that requires a calm, level-headed mindset. And yeah, so how did you prepare for that?
So the SWAT team, the Cincinnati Police Department SWAT team, is broken up into two different groups. One are the tactical officers, the men and the women who, you know, have all the nice toys, the different guns and all that kind of stuff. And then the negotiators. And the negotiators were the people that hopefully would do their job well enough so that the tactical team didn't have to go in and risk their life and risk the lives of hostages or hostage takers or barricaded people. So when there was an opening, I spent my entire life wanting to be part of the best, whatever I was doing. I mean, even when I was in business, I wanted to be the best at what I was doing, not just kind of, you know, occupying space. And so when there was an opening for the negotiators, I put in for it. And there was a physical fitness test. You had to run and do so many push-ups and pull-ups. There was a psychological test. You had to meet with the department psychologist, the people in charge, you know, were talking to your former bosses and asking, you know, is this the kind of person we want in this job? This is the requirements. And then there were interviews. And so it was a fairly lengthy process. And then, you know, it was like, yeah, we want you to be part of our team. And it was a team effort. There wasn't just, you know, one or two negotiators. I mean, we had probably 10 or 12 people at any given time that were trained to operate as negotiators. So it was just something that I did in addition to being a police officer. At the time I did it, I was in the drug unit. So I was working undercover, but I got out of the drug unit. I got promoted to sergeant. I went back to patrol and I was still doing it then. So I think I was a negotiator for about 4 years.
Well, in 2012, I know your life dramatically changed when you were diagnosed with the rare form of cancer that we mentioned earlier. And I understand that only 5,800 people are diagnosed with this cancer each year in the United States. Can you walk us through what happened to you in the beginning when it seemed as though life was going very well, you had found your passion, and then you needed to see a doctor? What happened?
Yeah, at the time, I had gotten out of law enforcement. We had moved from Cincinnati to Texas, and I was a girls' high school basketball coach. I had a school security consulting business. And it just happened to be during basketball season, I had a callus that broke open on the bottom of my foot, right below my third toe. And initially, I didn't think much of it because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot. But after a couple weeks of it not healing, I made an appointment and went to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine. And he took an X-ray and he's like, yeah, Terry, I think you got a little cyst in there and I can cut it out. And he did. And he showed it to me. It was just a little gelatin sack with some white fat in it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. And then 2 weeks later, I received a call from him. And as I mentioned, he was a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he was having explaining what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming. Until finally, he just laid it out for me. He said, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. I have never seen the form of cancer that you have. You have this rare form of melanoma that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands. And because your cancer is so incredibly rare, he recommended that I go to MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston and be treated. And so I did. And that started the 10-year journey with this disease.
And Terry, what were some of the emotions that you were going through? I would imagine just initially shocked that all of this was happening. And so tell us a little bit about how you felt.
Yeah, I think I went through all the emotions that we, you know, associate with grief. You know, I was in denial initially. It's like, no, wait a minute, this can't be. I've done everything right in my life. You know, I have a physical every year. I exercise, I eat right, I all this stuff. And then, you know, then you get mad. It's like, no, this can't possibly, you know, you get upset. Then you sort of start bargaining with God. Then you kind of get a little depressed, a little down. And then eventually I think you get to a point where you accept it. And I got to that point. I got, you know, it's like, this is not going to be fun, but these are the cards that I've been dealt. And I need to play these cards to the best of my ability. And that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years. I made a conscious decision early on that I would not take this out or blame or anything like that on any doctor that was trying to help me. I saw a lot of people do that. You know, they're having a bad day and you're taking it out on a nurse or a doctor. It's like, what are you doing that for? They're there to help you. They're not there, you know, to hurt you. I mean, there may be some pain involved in what they have to do to you, but at the same time, they're there to hurt you. Why are you upset with them? It's not their fault. So I've been really top of mind in terms of, I'm not taking this out on anybody. This is my cross to bear and I will do it to the best of my ability.
And Terry, it sounds like a lot of that is just the core of who you are as a person, how you were raised, a man of character. And I get that sense from reading your book and talking with you now. But how did your family help you as well when you were going through this period?
Yeah, that's a great question. I talk about the three F's that have got me through this, and those F stand for faith, family, and friends. And it's kind of a funny story. After I had my leg amputated, my doctor wanted to put me on chemotherapy. And, you know, I kind of looked at him like, is it going to save my life? And he was like, well, probably not, but it's going to buy you some more time. And I thought, you know what? I'm 8 years into this fight. I am not afraid to die. And given that the consequences were going to be the same, I wasn't sure I wanted to go through that and to do that. And so I was like, okay, you know, that fine. We'll deal with it. And so I went home and I said, I'll talk to my family about it. I go home and start talking to my wife and daughter. And my daughter's all of a sudden, we need a family meeting. I'm like, family meeting? There's three of us. It's not like we got a board here or something like that. You know, it's like, so we all sit around the kitchen table and talk about how we want to deal with this situation. And then my daughter raises, you know, he's like, okay, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raise their hand. I'm like, wait a minute. Am I getting outvoted for something that I don't want to do? But I remember back to the police academy when our defensive tactics instructor was telling us, you will fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself.
I truly believe that is so true. And your experience is just a personal testament to that. So when you started taking, you know, the drug that was supposed to help you, can you talk a little bit about that and how it really became toxic for your body that you ended up in the ICU? That journey, can you talk a little bit about that and the struggles you experienced and had to overcome?
Absolutely. So after I had the two surgeries to remove the tumor on the bottom of my foot and all the lymph nodes in my groin, after I healed, my doctor put me on the drug called interferon. And interferon for me was a weekly injection that was just horrible, nasty, and debilitating. And the side effects of interferon is that it gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection. And I took those weekly injections for 5 years. So imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And that was not a cure. That was just, as my oncologist used to say, we're trying to kick the can down the road to buy you more time for additional therapies to become available. So during that period of time, I was so sick of being sick that I literally prayed to die. I would just ask God, like, look, please, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep being, you know, having the flu every, you know, throwing up and achy and headache. I mean, all the things we associated with a bad case of the flu every single week. But God didn't take me. I mean, he gave me the strength to handle it. And then I was on that drug for 5 years. And then in 2017, the medication, the interferon, became so toxic to my body that I ended up in the intensive care unit with a fever of 108 degrees, which usually is not compatible with being alive. I was fortunate that I had presented at a level one trauma center emergency room, and they were able to stabilize me before sending me to the intensive care unit. But because of the toxicity of the drug, I had to stop it. I couldn't take it anymore. And almost immediately after stopping the interferon, the cancer came back in the exact same spot on my foot where it had presented 5 years earlier. So, you know, 5 years of having the flu really ended up being, well, we're right back at square one.
Well, and if you're comfortable talking about this, can you just share with us a little bit more about the emotions that surfaced when the cancer kept coming back? And what gave you the resolve to say, I'm not giving up, I'm going to fight, I'm going to fight, I'm going to fight?
Yeah, I think a lot of it just had to do with my background. I mean, I started playing basketball when I was 9 years old, and I was fortunate enough to play all the way up through after I graduated from college. And I think one of the things that being part of a team sport teaches you is the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. And you realize on a team that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but you let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, et cetera. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. And so I knew that, you know, this disease is probably going to take my life. And that's okay. We all have to die from time, you know, at some point in our lives. But I wanted to make sure I could do as much as possible. And the chemotherapy, which I ended up taking, really acted as a bridge to allow me to be on the drug that I'm on now. I'm on a clinical trial drug that does nothing to the cancer except to unmask it for my body to see and to be able to fight. So it's probably not going to save my life, but it may save the life of somebody, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, based on the data that the doctors are gleaning from my blood work, my scans, et cetera. So I, you know, it's kind of the way you look at it. It's, you know, do you have to go to treatment or do you get to go to treatment? Do you have to go to work or do you get to go to work? You know, do you have to whatever you're doing or do you get to whatever you're doing? And for me, I hate my treatments. My treatments make me throw up. They make me shake violently. I have a headache. I do this every 3 weeks and I've been doing it for almost 2 years now. But it's not about me. It's about who can I help by going through this ugly time. And that's really what sustains me. And I'm no hero. I'm no saint. But I really feel that hopefully what I'm going through will benefit somebody else sometime down the road.
And Terry, that is just so remarkable what you said, how you can help someone else, even in your personal struggle and pain and all that you've been through. And I am just sitting here just astonished that the humbleness and the caring and the compassion that you have in your heart, and you're living that. So let's go to 2020, when you learned that had to have your leg, the amputation of your leg above the knee. And that journey and that process, the recovery process, what was that like for you?
It was horrible because I had this, I'd had a procedure in December of 2019, and everybody thought that the problem I was having sort of in my ankle area was a result of that procedure. They didn't realize that it was a tumor that was growing out of control in that area to the point where my entire lower leg was full of cancer, and that tumor had grown large enough where it broke my leg. Basically, I was walking around, I wasn't walking too much, but I was walking around on a broken leg until they were able to scan it. And I had a therapist who they were sending me to, who got with the doctor and said, "Something's wrong here. You need to scan him. This shouldn't be happening." And they found out I had these you know, tumors in my lungs, in addition to having the broken leg and all the cancer. And so this was 2020. And so my surgeon was a super guy, and he ended up arranging to have my surgery at a hospital that did not accept COVID patients. That being said, literally my wife, the day of the surgery, my wife dropped me off at the hospital. I was not allowed to have anybody with me. My surgeon had to get special permission from the hospital administration to actually perform the surgery. And I was the only operation scheduled that day. I mean, if you've ever been in a pre-op area where, you know, it's divided off by curtains and you got all these patients waiting to have different surgeries, I was the only person in that whole area. I mean, it was so quiet and almost scary to a point. And my doctor said, you know, normally we would have you in the hospital for a week. We're going to have you in for 48 hours. We're going to make the occupational and the physical therapist teach you everything you need to know in 48 hours, which drove them crazy. I mean, they were working late into the night to teach me everything I needed to know to go home and not hurt myself and to be able to heal. And so it was not a normal thing where you would have surgery, because it was right in the middle of the pandemic.
So as you're going through the healing process, when did you have the foresight to say, "I'm going to write a book now"? And why? What was so meaningful about that, sharing your story with others?
I guess it was, I think I've alluded to the fact that I have a fairly strong faith. And there's kind of that old joke that says, you know, when we talk to God, it's called prayer. When God talks to us, it's called schizophrenia. So I'm not going to sit here and say that God ever talked to me. He didn't. But I think what God did was put people in my path that were saying, "Hey, Terry, you should write a book. Hey, Terry, you should write a book." And the more people that did that, I think I'm smart enough to kind of kind of buck up and be like, hey, maybe I ought to pay attention to this. And, you know, obviously going through, you know, a major surgery like having your leg amputated and things like that, you have to be able, you have to be in the right mindset. You have to be able to have the time in that. And so I had the time. I had a young man reach out to me from college on social media, and he asked me what I thought were the most important things that he should learn to not just be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. And I didn't want to give him the, you know, get up early, work hard, help others. Not that those aren't important. They are incredibly important. But I wanted to see if I could go deeper with him. So I spent some time and I took some notes, and eventually I had these 10 thoughts, these 10 ideas, these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then I kind of stepped back and I was like, well, I got a life story that fits underneath this principle, or I know somebody whose life emulates that principle. So literally during the 3-month period where I was healing after my leg amputation and before I started chemotherapy, I sat down at the computer every day and I built stories, and they're real stories about real people underneath each of the principles. And that's how the book came to be.
That's incredible. And Terry, I just want to mention to our listeners again, the title of the book is Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. And I recommend it to all of our listeners. But when you talk in the book about excellence, now, what is excellence and how do you achieve it? And most importantly, how do you sustain it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And most people aren't going to like my answer, because when people ask me what excellence is, my response is, I don't know. I don't know what excellence is. I know excellence when I see it. But to the listeners, or, you know, to you, Ralph, you may look at somebody and say, hey, that person's excellent at, you know, whatever, X, Y, and Z. And I may look at them and say, yeah, they're good, but I don't think they're excellent. So I think excellence, like beauty, is in a lot of ways in the eye of the beholder. You have to determine excellence for yourself, and you have to determine excellence for something else, something outside you. And that's an individual thing. But taking that and saying, okay, let's say you've arrived, you know, you've achieved what you believe to be excellence. And you know, let's say you start a company and you get to where you want to be with your goals. And what do most people do? They sort of sit back and, you know, put their feet up on the desk and be like, man, I've arrived. Look at me. You know, look what I've done. Here's my company. It's great. You know, everything's still going super. And then what happens? 6 months later, a year later, boom, somebody surpasses you. Somebody, you know, is now all of a sudden they're better than you at this particular thing. How did that happen? It happened because you didn't sustain your excellence. And you sustain excellence by adapting, by doing different things, by constantly changing the dynamic of your business, because you have to do that. Otherwise, people are going to see how you got there and they're going to replicate that. And sometimes people are just better than you or smarter than you, and they're going to surpass you. So you have to constantly look to innovate, constantly look to change, constantly look to get better. And that's the problem with a lot of people. They get to that, to the top of the mountain, so to speak, and then they just sit back and sort of, well, I can coast now because, you know, I've arrived. I'm excellent. And somebody surpasses them. And they're like, oh, my gosh, how did that happen? Well, it happened because you didn't sustain it. You didn't change. You didn't adapt. You didn't innovate. So once you get to excellence, however you define that, the way you sustain it is by adapting, changing, and innovating.
And that's an important takeaway, that regardless of where you are in your life, that you can apply. But I'm wondering, what are the other key takeaways you'd like readers to have from after they read your book?
I think a couple things. I mean, each chapter in the book is a principle. And it's always fun for me as an author when people reach out to me after reading it, because usually there's one principle within the book that resonates with the reader. I mean, that really kind of, you know, cuts close to the heart. And even, you know, I wrote all 10 of the principles, and one of them resonates with me. And it resonates with me because I know I've done this, and I've probably done this more times in my life than I care to admit. And one of the principles, one of the chapters is this: most people think with their fears and their insecurities instead of using their minds. You know, how many times have I done, hey, I should do that. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I'm not smart enough. Maybe I'm not good enough. Wait a minute. What if I fail? What are other people going to say? That's thinking with our fears and our insecurities, not our minds, because our minds are like, hey, we should do that. And I always tell, especially young people, if there's something in your heart, something in your soul that you believe you're supposed to do, but it scares you, go ahead and do it. Because at the end of your life, the things that you're going to regret are not going to be the things you did. They're going to be the things you didn't do. And by then, it's going to be too late to go back and do them. So don't think with your fears and your insecurities. Think with your minds. That's one thing I'd like them to learn. Another thing that I think is important is one of the other chapters is about you are the person you're looking to become. So even if you're not that person today, you are that person. And I know that probably doesn't make a lot of sense, but it will. You will get there. You will get to that person. And so you are that person. You need to think like that. You need to act like that to do that. And I guess maybe that's another good point. You know, a lot of times in life, we're always about setting goals. But I think the part that people miss before they set goals is they don't determine what their values in life are. In some cases, what are you willing to lay your life down for? And if you understand your values and you use your values to then set your goals, one, you'll be a whole lot happier. And two, you will have goals that you'll be willing to sacrifice for. Not, you know, hey, I got to have $10 million by the time I'm 25 years old, or I got to be driving a Lamborghini, or I got to be living in this kind of a house. Those aren't the goals that are based on values. Those are goals based on what society is telling you is going to make you happy. So I think that's another thing. And then I'll just end it with this. The last chapter, and again, the chapters are not in any particular order, but the last chapter is about the importance of love. And I know, you know, especially guys get together, guys don't talk about love. That's not something we need, you know, that we traditionally talk about. But I think it is so important. I think it's important to love your God. I think it's important to love yourself. And I think it's important to love your fellow man. And if you can keep that in mind, I've always believed that our purpose in life is to serve. And if you can serve with love, you're going to have a great life.
Terry, I mean, just what you said, the importance of love, God, and self. If we all applied that in our individual life, you just wonder what our society, our world would be like. So I wanted to ask you about the website Motivational Check that you started. Can you tell us a little bit about this title and where it comes from and the purpose of the website?
Sure. I mean, the website is kind of happened the same way the book did. People were like, you know, you ought to start this, you know, this website, this blog. And I was totally against it. I'm like, I'm old. I can barely turn my cell phone on in the morning. What do you mean you want me to start a blog? And when I started Motivational Check, it was initially 4 pages. And this is no lie. It took me 4 months to put those 4 pages together. I'm sure my 25-year-old daughter could have done it in about 15 minutes. But, you know, for me, I didn't understand it. And it was a tremendous learning process of I'd get to a point, I'd get stuck. Oh, wait a minute, I've got to go learn about that and find out about it. Okay, now I can move forward a little bit. But Motivational Check, every day I put up a thought for the day. And with that thought comes a question about maybe how you can apply that thought into your life. And then also on Mondays, I put up the Monday morning motivational message, which is a video or a story that I found that I think has some relevance to people's lives. There are recommendations on there for videos to watch, books to read. Some of the podcasts I've been on are on there. My social media sites are on there. But the title came from something that occurred when I was in the police academy. When our defensive tactics instructor, we went through some very difficult things. We ran a marathon. We did all kinds of stuff like that. And he gave us that phrase, motivational check, as a way for us to, if we were having a bad day, if we just couldn't go on, if, you know, we were hurting, we could just scream out or yell out motivational check. And we were the 84th recruit class in the police academy. And the rest of the class would respond by yelling out 84 to let that person know, hey, we're in this together. So, you know, lean on us, hang out with us. We will get you to where you need to go. We will get this together as a class. But individually, I know you're hurting, but together we're going to make this happen.
And Terry, is there one favorite quote of inspiration or thought of the day that you'd like to share with us today that inspires you and helps you maintain your positive attitude?
I like to give this quote. John Wooden was a basketball coach at UCLA when I was growing up. Very successful coach, won many national championships. He runs 7 national championships in a row. He's also very famous for what he calls his pyramid of success. And you would think that this incredibly successful coach would define success as some type of winning. You know, I've got to be able to win. But here's what his definition of success is. Success is peace of mind. Think about that. Success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction in knowing that you did the best to become the best that you're capable of becoming. And I love that because it doesn't say anything about winning or losing. It just says you have peace of mind because you did the very best you could to become the best person that you can become. I think that's just a great definition of success. However, again, however you define excellence, however you define success, I think that really hits the mark.
Yes, it does. A peace of mind and doing the best. Yeah. Love it, Terry. Well, on our podcast, and it's hard to believe that we're coming to the end of the session, but I'd like to end our discussion with the segment that we call The Shift to Joy. And we asked our guests, what brings them joy and makes them happy? So, Terry, what do you do to bring you joy into your life?
I interact with people. I've spent the last 45 minutes or so talking about, you know, how you can be resilient and how you can overcome. I guess I want your listeners to understand that, you know what, I'm a human being. I mean, there's no S on my chest. I don't wear a cape and fly around with magical powers. I have bad days. There are days I cry. There are days I get down. There are days I feel sorry for myself. And when I do, I look at that and say, okay, Terry, you're looking internally. You're looking at yourself and you're feeling sorry for yourself. And I think what helps me is to take that ugliness, to take those feelings, and then to say, okay, I'm going to project outward now. I'm going to stop looking inside. I'm going to look outward. Who can I help? Whose life can I make a difference to? Who can I go up to and say, hey, how you doing? Everything okay? You want to talk? You want to get a cup of coffee? Whatever it is, how can I make a difference in somebody else's life? And if you do that, now all of a sudden, you're not focused inward. You're not focused on all the ugliness. You're focused on helping another human being. And I remember I had a nurse recently who asked me, you know, what was it like to have your foot amputated and then have your leg amputated? And I told her, I said, you know, it hasn't been easy. I mean, it's been over 2 years since my amputation of my leg, and I'm still learning how to walk again with a prosthetic leg. But what I told her was, is that cancer can take all my physical faculties, but cancer can't touch my mind, it can't touch my heart, and it can't touch my soul. And that's who I am. I mean, that's who you are, Ralph. That's who everybody who's listening to us is. This is just a house or a vessel to house who we really are. So don't get too excited if, you know, oh, you know what? I'm not that attractive. I'm not, you know, I've lost an arm. I'm blind or whatever. You know what? That's not who you are. Who you are is your heart, your mind, and your soul. If you remember that, you're always going to be happy.
And Terry, as we wrap up this session, is there anything else you would like to mention before we say goodbye to you?
If you don't mind, I'd like to close with one final story. I've always been a big fan of Westerns growing up. My mom and dad used to let me stay up late and watch Gunsmoke and Bonanza and Wild Wild West. 1993, the movie Tombstone came out. You may have seen it. It was a huge blockbuster. It's still being shown on reruns on different television stations. It starred Val Kilmer as a man by the name of John Doc Holliday and Kurt Russell as a man by the name of Wyatt Earp. Now, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp were two living, breathing human beings who walked on the face of the earth. They're not made-up characters just for the movie. Now, Doc was called Doc because he was a dentist by trade, but pretty much Doc Holliday was a gunslinger and a card shark. And Wyatt Earp had been a lawman most of his adult life. And somehow these two men from entirely opposite backgrounds come together and form this very close friendship. And towards the end of the movie, there's a scene where Doc is dying at a sanitarium in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 3 hours from where I live. And the real Doc Holliday died at that sanitarium, and he's buried in the Glenwood Springs Cemetery. And Wyatt Earp at this time is destitute. He has no money, He has no job. He has no prospects for a job. So every day he comes to play cards with Doc, and the two men pass the time that way. And in almost this last scene of the movie, they're talking about what they want out of life. And Doc says, you know, I was in love with my cousin when I was young, but she joined a convent over the affair. But she's all I ever wanted. And he looks at Wyatt and he says, what about you, Wyatt? What do you want? And Wyatt kind of nonchalantly says, I just want to lead a normal life. And Doc looks at him and says, there's no normal. There's just life. And get on with living yours. Ralph, you and I probably know people. There's probably people out there listening to it who are just sitting back and saying, you know what? When this happens, I'll have a normal life. Or when that occurs, I'll have a successful life. Or when this arises, I'll have a significant life. What I'd like to leave you with is this. Don't wait. Don't wait for life to come to you. Get out there. Find the reason you were put on the face of this earth. Use your unique gifts and talents and live that reason. Because if you do, at the end of your life, I'm going to promise you two things. Number one, you're going to be a whole lot happier. And number two, you're going to have a whole lot more peace in your heart.
Wow. My heartfelt thanks to you, Terry Tucker, for just taking the time today to chat with me. And you have really touched my life and inspired me to live my best life. And I just can't thank you enough. And I know our listeners were really engaged in this discussion and learning from you. So I'd like to just thank all of our listeners for taking the time. And please don't forget to share our link of the podcast today to your friends and family. We'd love to see your comments and thoughts, so please keep them coming. And most importantly, don't forget to take a little time to spread some joy today.